Welcome to another episode of Fair Conversations, part of the Mormon Faircast. My name is Blair Hodges. I'm host of Fair Conversations. The Foundation for Apologetic Information and Research is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing well-documented answers to criticisms of LDS doctrine, belief, and practice. To learn more about FAIR or to make donations, visit fairlds.org. In this episode, I'm joined by Matthew Bowman, who recently received his PhD in American Religious History from Georgetown University, and he currently teaches American Religious History at Hampden-Sydney College in Virginia. He's the author of Random House's brand new one-volume history of the LDS Church called The Mormon People, The Making of an American Faith. Matthew joined me by Skype from Virginia to talk about the new book. Questions or comments about this episode can be sent to podcast@fairlds.org, or you can join the conversation at fairblog.org. All right, thanks for joining us for another episode of Fair Conversations. I'm Blair Hodges, and today I'm joined by Matthew Bowman. Matthew received his PhD in American Religious History from Georgetown University in 2011, and he also has a master's in American History from the University of Utah. Most recently, Matt published a book called The Mormon People with Random House, which is a one-volume overview of the history of the church. And Matt joins us today from Hampden-Sydney College in Virginia, and that's where you're a visiting professor of religious history there. Thanks for joining us today, Matt. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks.
Good. I wanted to start off by letting you take a minute to talk about your academic background a little bit, why you chose to study what you're studying and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I think, you know, it's a very common academic story. You'll all say, well, I started out doing one thing and now I'm over on another continent doing something else. That is true for me. I entered Georgetown intending to write a dissertation about politics in the American Progressive Era. I stayed in that time period, but ended up writing a dissertation about evangelical religious life and the development of evangelical theology in urban America in the Progressive Era. And, you know, that changed, I think, because I grew more and more interested in religious history. And it seemed to me that in a lot of ways, religious history wasn't being done well. And I hoped that I might be someone who was able to do it right, which is a lofty and grandiose claim. I hope I succeeded to at least some extent.
What sort of things didn't you like about the history that you'd seen so far?
I think a lot of American religious history, especially that in the 20th century, and especially that about evangelicals who are massively underserved, actually. I think evangelicals get a lot of crap, which they don't deserve. But too much of it is overtly political. Too much of it is really kind of writing about the rise of the religious right in the guise of writing about the history of evangelicalism in America. And I wanted to do justice, I think, to the more cultural and less political aspects of what it is to be a religious person.
Did you find that to be a hard thing to do with the new book, because it's a pretty politically charged environment right now as far as religion and politics is concerned? So
yes. And I think the book exists precisely for that reason. The book exists because a Mormon is running for president, and I don't think it would exist other than that. So, you know, and I think actually a lot of the criticism that has been leveled at the book is for that reason, is that this book doesn't explain to us why people should be afraid of electing Mitt Romney president. You know, this book does not address many of the more sensational and lurid things that people believe about Mormons. I think it may be too much an academic book for some people, and maybe too sober, if I can make a word of wisdom pun.
Yeah, okay. Let's return to that in just a minute here. But before we do, you're also a member of the LDS Church. You're a Mormon, and you're also of an academic bent. So I'm curious as to how those two things inform each other. Has your Mormonism informed your scholarship in any peculiar ways, and vice versa?
Mm-hmm. I think certainly I write about Mormonism because I'm a Mormon. and actually, I think it's sort of the reverse. I think that my faith and my spiritual life are deeper because I'm an academic. I sometimes say that, you know, that Paul in Corinthians talks about gifts that people are given, you know, and some people are given charity, and some people are given the Spirit, and some people are given to prophesy. And I think my I am given to be an intellectual, you know, and to whatever extent I become a Christian, it will be because I think my way there, as Christine Paglen put it once, and she's absolutely right, you know, that my spiritual life is connected to my intellectual life in ways that I find very difficult to separate. And, you know, we have had so many conversations and arguments in Mormonism over the past 30 years about the relationship between the mind and the soul and the intellect and faith. And I think it's an incredibly false dichotomy. And I think the history of Christianity writ large reveals how false a dichotomy it is.
You mentioned Christine Haglund. Do you work with her at Dialogue, right?
I do.
So she's the editor. And what sort of work do you do with the journal?
Oh, I'm sort of I am. Well, I was going to make a James Bond analogy here, but I am her odd job. You know, I do whatever she asks me to do. More or less, she will throw me articles to review. She will ask me who should review certain books. I sometimes go out and headhunt and recruit people. Like there was last year that roundtable conversation between Susanna Morrill, Robert Orsi, and Richard Bushman. I put that together, and I wrote the introduction and kind of set up all the questions for that. So, you know, I do a little bit of everything.
More recently, you've sort of emerged as one of these public voices on Mormonism in this what's being called the Mormon moment, and I was interested in your take to return to something you mentioned earlier, your take on how your book is a product of that Mormon moment.
Well, it exists because Mitt Romney ran for president. It exists because of that. But I think. Also, you know, in some ways, I'm trying to explain in the book why we keep having Mormon moments. 10 years ago, there was an article in Time magazine, which was titled The Mormon Moment, and it was about the coming Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City. And the theme of the article ran as such. Mormons are an odd and strange little American religion, but they're trying to become more culturally respectable. Are they going to be able to do it? Will the Mormons ever pass the threshold of being in the American mainstream? And it's 10 years later, and we're having exactly the same conversation, which indicates to me, you know, there is this sort of ongoing tension between being Mormon and being an American. There are things in which those two things mesh very well. There are also issues in which the two seem very, very far apart. And to what extent can we resolve this tension? I don't know necessarily that we can, or if it's desirable to. So, you know, and that's the tension I explore in the book. And I think it is perhaps in a meditation on what a Mormon woman is as much as a history of the church.
Is that sort of what the publishers envisioned, or how did they work with you as far as what the direction of the book was going to be?
They gave me a great deal of leeway. I was asked to write a one-volume history of Mormonism, and I said, what would you like it to look like? And they said, a one-volume history of Mormonism. And so I had a great deal of freedom in how I approached it.
You had a couple of earlier sort of books that we have one-volume histories, but they're all a little bit older. There's mm-hmm. Davis Bitten and Leonard Arrington's Mormon Experience. There's the Story of the Latter-day Saints by Allen and Glenn Leonard. Mm-hmm. Did you find yourself drawing a lot on the work of previous Mormon historians? Mm-hmm. It's your work seems to be a synthesis of sort of the last 4 decades of scholarship on Mormon history.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. There's also the Bushmans about 10 years ago published a short history with Oxford. That's useful. And I did draw on all of those. But as you say, you know, the two large books, the Leonard Allen, Bitten, Arrington, those are 40 years old now. And so, you know, so much has been written about Mormonism since, but also a lot has happened since, you know, that has, I think, kind of clarified things that would have been current events for those guys. We can look back and see the 60s and 70s as being a particular phase in Mormon history. So yeah, I wanted to do two things when I wrote this book. I wanted to first produce a new synthesis, something that drew all of the scholarship of the last 4 years together and produced some hopefully coherent narrative. But I also wanted to give due diligence to the 20th century, which is sort of the great wasteland of Mormon history. We have a few good biographies. you know, but there's no real overarching narrative of what 20th century Mormonism was like. And that is, I think, something that we're ready for and something I hope I was able to always take steps towards establishing.
Do you think there's anything in particular that inhibits that sort of Mormon history? I mean, we think of history of being something old, and this that would be contemporary history. So are there factors that are sort of standing in the way of more Mormon works on more contemporary Mormonism, do you think?
Oh, you know, I think, frankly, it's been overlooked in part because compared to Joseph Smith, it's boring. And many people who are drawn to, I think, the real fantastic and powerful origin stories of the church are much less interested in the 20th century, because by this point, you're writing about institutions and you're writing about procedures and you're writing about policy making and other things that just aren't as sexy, if I might say, as Joseph Smith is. Yeah, and that's a stereotype, I think, to be sure, but it's a stereotype that I think has inhibited a lot of this work.
What are some of the more significant developments in scholarship that have happened over the past, say, 20 years since those earlier books were published? Do you see some of these significant developments that your book has been able to incorporate?
Well, I think the first things are work done in the 20th century and work not necessarily even historical in nature. Sociology, to be sure, Armand Mauss's book, I think, on the 20th century is sort of the skeleton of what a narrative of 20th century Mormonism might look like. I lean to some degree on that. And more in the more recent periods, from the 80s to the present, I leaned a lot on really contemporary scholarship. I'm forgetting the title of the book, but Tim Heaton and Carol, what's your last name? Carol, somebody at BYU edited
Carol Cornwell.
No, not her. It's a sociologist.
Oh, this is the one about social. It's a collection of essays about
contemporary Mormonism, something like that. I drew a lot on that book. Gary and Gordon Shepherd, who are two sociologists who have written about Mormonism and who have never gotten the attention they deserve, I think. So
I studied sort of general conference addresses
Things like that. But also missions. They've done work on missions as well. Right. 20th century. Which I found useful and valuable. So I think, sociology for the 20th century was quite useful to me.
How about globally? I mean, I see some work coming out. For example, Reed Nelson from the Church History Department himself, he's published some works on more trying to get a little bit more international. Were you able to incorporate much of that into?
I did. You know, I was. And getting back to the publishers, they said they specified in America.
Okay.
So I didn't go as much into that as I could have, but I did use Reed's work. There's not a lot of Mormon missiology stuff. There's a lot of histories of missions, but no kind of mission theory of Mormonism, which I think, we may be moving towards. David Knowlton's stuff on missions in Latin America, I used some as well. Yeah.
Was anything left on the cutting room floor that you wish was still in the book?
No, actually, they published almost every word I wrote. I wish I had written more, but I think since I finished the book, I've been kind of pushing forward with chapter 6, which is about Mormonism in the Progressive Era, and I'm hoping to do more work on that. And I think incorporate some stuff that I wish I had. I wish, for instance, I had included more Susan Young Gates and Amy Brown Lyman. And their role in developing social services work and organizational work in the early 20th century.
Didn't one of them even somehow go to the Hull House in back
east or
something?
That was Amy Brown Lyman. She met Jane Addams in Chicago and then came back and was put in charge of the church social services by Joseph Smith and then Heber J. Grant. I wish so much I had had a section on those two, but it's not there because I was writing very quickly and just was not able to get it in.
You say very quickly, and I've the rumor is that you finished this puppy in an astoundingly fast period. How long did it take to write the book?
10 weeks. It says it's in the introduction, actually, right beneath my name, June 24th to September 14th. start to finish.
So did you dictate it to a scribe, or did you do it?
Oh, with the seer stones, right? No, I fired up my laptop and wrote 30 pages a week for 10 weeks.
That's a breakneck pace.
It really is. And I think, you know, the book suffers, I think, a little from that, because there just was not much time to go back and put new stuff in and sort of pull back and think, in a large kind of perspectival sense of what I was
doing. What sort of reactions to the book from other people have you received so far?
Oh, kind of, well, all over the place. You know, I've gotten hostile reviews saying I've been too favorable to the Mormons. I have also gotten a great deal of praise from non-Mormons who say, non-Mormons who knew nothing about Mormonism, who said it was very useful to them. I have gotten emails from members of the church who wanted to send missionaries to my house. I have gotten emails from members of the church who are infuriated that I talked about Joseph Smith and polygamy. So I've gotten dinged from all sides.
What sort of complaint would they have about that? I mean, polygamy is, it occurred, so, you know.
Yep. But, you know, there are parts of that that don't make Joseph Smith look good. And I think, you know, I think there are members of the church for whom discussions like this are out of bounds.
Yeah, what's interesting is you hit on a lot of these less comfortable issues in the book. You talk about polygamy, you talk about Mountain Meadows Massacre, you talk about, you know, difficulties with the Book of Abraham and things like that. So these are sort of blacks in the priesthood is another thing, women and priesthood authority is another issue, and you cover all these topics, and so people can pick up the book and kind of read through it and see what you say. But what are some of the under the radar Mormon topics that you covered in the book that perhaps people don't expect and it's not on the laundry list of things?
Yeah. I have the closest to this I have seen is Alexander's book, Mormonism in Transition, which is exhaustive and essential. But I think I treat Talmadge and Roberts and those guys, I treat them in a somewhat new way. A way that's not really been there's not been a lot of interpretation like the interpretation I give of them, which is to put them in dialogue with people like Simon Patton and Jane Addams and other progressive Americans. And I haven't, you know, and I think that is something that is relatively new, and I have not gotten a lot of feedback on that yet. Another thing is I try fairly hard to treat Bruce R. McConkie as a serious theologian. And to take him really seriously as a thinker and to perhaps put him in conversation with people he would not be comfortable being in conversation with, being other Christian theologians from other denominations and other traditions. And I hope I did him justice.
What sort of surprising things do you have in there then that people might not expect? You spend, like you said, you spend some time there with Bruce R. McConkie, and what sort of new ideas were you able to tease out looking at him as a theologian?
About McConkie?
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I kind of toss this off in a sentence, but McConkie is very much a modernist thinker. We don't think of him that way. We think of him as being kind of anti-modern and very retrograde, but he's not. He's actually a man who's quite optimistic and quite confident about human potential and the ability of the human mind and will to perfect ourselves, you know, which makes him, I think, a very kind of classic guy with a lot more in common with John Wixow than he might think. Or maybe he would, actually. I think it's entirely possible McConkie would say, yeah, I have a ton of stuff in common with John Wixow. But no one kind of would acknowledge that because we tend to think of John Wixow as being a quote-unquote liberal thinker and McConkie as a conservative thinker.
Right, and part of that ties into the narrative about the so-called Mormon neo-orthodoxy, which is this move in the 20th century back towards a more original sin-oriented Mormonism where there's sort of a depravity sort of a thing. And do you think Bruce R. McConkie plays into that narrative as well, or do you see him in a different light?
I don't like that word. There is neo-orthodoxy, which is this Christian idea, guys like Reinhold Niebuhr, Emil Brunner, Karl Barth, to some degree, are all considered neo-orthodox theologians. They are, though, guys who do take original sin very seriously. McConkie doesn't take original sin very seriously. McConkie is very stern, and he's very moralistic. and he's very strict, but he is not thinking of original sin the same way actual Protestant neo-Orthodox theologians are. He's also not at all like American neo-Orthodox theologians like Paul Tillich or Niebuhr. These are guys who did not believe that Adam and Eve existed. These are guys who took scripture. Niebuhr's famous phrase is, we cannot take the Bible literally, but we must take it seriously. And McConkie, of course, takes scripture extremely literally. He takes it. He believes in all the miracles of Christ in a very real way. So I don't think McConkie actually has much in common with American neo-Orthodox thinkers much at all. I get into that some in the bibliographic essay, less so in the main text of the book. Because, you know, that seemed a bit inside baseball.
It is a little bit inside baseball, but I did think it was an important point, and it was one that I hadn't really fully considered, was just that the observation that you make, or the analysis that you make of Bruce R. McConkie is more than just a stern conservative person with a dark view of humanity. And that's part of why some non-LDS Christians react strongly against McConkie's, because of his insistence on a human's ability to do works.
McConkie is an extraordinary Pelagian, you know. Very, and so was John Witzel, for that matter. You know, if you read like Rational Theology for Witzel, he's like try hard, work hard, cultivate your personality, and oh yeah, the atonement.
So here's the thing: in the book, you have to tackle these issues. So you go through Witzel and Elder Talmage. And B.H. Roberts and Bruce R. McConkie, and then, you know, right after that, you're segueing into Saturday's Warrior. So how was it to sort of deal with the Mormon pop cultural aspects of things?
Oh gosh, I don't consider Saturday's Warrior pop culture. I consider Saturday's Warrior like the fifth book in the standard works in a lot of ways. Saturday's Warrior is tremendously influential on 20th century Mormonism. I think it shapes Mormon theology as much as Bruce R. McConkie does, or I should say popular Mormon theology. I think thinking about the pre-existence, thinking about, you know, our role here on earth, thinking about marriage, in all sorts of ways, I think Saturday's Warrior shapes as well as reflects what Mormons believed in the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
So another aspect of the book that, and we mentioned this a little bit earlier, is the political aspect, and you didn't want the book to be overridden by politics, but politics still plays a pretty considerable role in the book, especially when it comes to Mormonism's embrace of the Republican Party, mostly in the 20th century. How do you see that happening? Because Mormons went from being targeted by the Republican Party based on the twin pillars of barbarism, which were slavery and polygamy. So they went from that to embracing the Republican Party. So how do you describe that transition in Mormonism?
Oh, that starts early, actually. It starts in the 19th century. I think in large part because many Mormon leaders, many wealthier, better-to-do Mormons are actually moving into the Republican Party's demographic in the late 19th century. That being kind of urban, well-educated, fairly well-off middle-class Americans. So by the 1880s, 1890s, a number of Mormon leaders are feeling sympathetic to Republicanism simply because they're part of their target audience. But the Republican Party also is a large help to Mormons as they're looking for Utah statehood. The Republicans are the party who helps kind of guide that through, ease it through into the Senate. And then by the early 20th century, again, a lot of the leading classes in Mormons are Republicans. Joseph F. Smith is a Republican. Reed Smoot, of course. Heber J. Grant. All of these guys are sympathetic to Republicanism economically and culturally. Now, this is true, though. There is still many of the kind of the rank and file of the church are Democrats in the same period. The Democrats are, in this period, the party of the farmers, the party of factory workers, the party of the kind of working class. And this is why I think Utah goes for William Jennings Bryan, and it goes for Franklin Roosevelt over and over and over. So it's not really till the rise of the 60s and the countercultural movement and all of these sort of more socially liberal groups begin appearing on the American stage, and Mormons find themselves increasingly on the side of social conservatives. And I think it's that, in large measure, which gets much of the rank and file into the Republican Party fairly late, by the 80s and 90s. Utah's still electing Democrats governor and to the Senate in the 70s and 80s. So it's not until the 90s that Utah really, I think, makes the transition into republicanism more generally. There is also, of course, this sort of moralistic libertarian strain that emerges out of Ezra Taft Benson and Cleon Skousen and these guys who are kind of creating this sort of theology of libertarianism that appears in Mormonism in the 60s and 70s, which is, I think, another important strand to the growing Republican majority. And because it's moralistic, it really fuses nicely with this social conservatism that begins to appear.
There's a part in the book when you dissect a particularly interesting time period as far as the church and politics is concerned, and mm-hmm. that's during Spencer W. Kimball's tenure as president, because you had a couple of interesting things that happened during that time. You have the Equal Rights Amendment, and you also had the MX missile situation. Yes. So how do you see those two events sort of – how did Americans perceive the church's movement on those? Because it seemed counterintuitive as far as one compared to the other.
Right, right. And you know, and that's what I love about Kimball. He's full of surprises. Right. When I discuss this period and all, like the ERA and then the MX and then the revocation of the ban and all of that, you know, it's sort of I like that period because it still sort of indicates the extent to which the church is not, in fact, just kind of become an appendage of the Republican Party, right? It still has a sort of capacity for a prophetic voice. It still has this capacity to take a stand based upon theology, based upon moral issues that defy the sort of growing partisan orthodoxy that many Republicans were expecting the church was fully on board with.
One of the entire chapters of the book is called Correlation, and you talk about the rise of the correlation movement. Where do you place the roots of that movement in the church as far as correlation hierarchical and also when it deals with our church manuals and instruction books? It's larger.
Yeah. I mean, this is also the chapter where I talk about Saturday's Warrior.
Right.
And the chapter where I talk about McConkie as a theologian and all of that, you know, there is kind of a correlation culture that coincides with the emergence of the correlation organizational movement. The organizational movement, I think, really has roots, and I try to make this clear in the book, it has roots in the sort of progressive reform that you see Joseph Fielding Smith begin to implement in the early 20th, and Amy Brown Lyman and all the rest of them begin to implement in the early 20th century. This sort of conviction that organization actually can be a vehicle for purifying souls. An organization can be a way to inculcate morals and virtues into people. And I think that the full-fledged correlation in the 50s and 60s is really a reflection of that really kind of idealistic, progressive idea. So on one hand, then, you have kind of the rise of a very correlated church, of a very controlled curriculum for all the auxiliaries, a very centralized church on priesthood leadership. But you also have kind of the rise of this culture that emphasizes ethical behavior and morality and living a good life and identifies those things as being what it is to be a good Mormon.
Yeah, there's a really interesting discussion in your book about some of the benefits and drawbacks to correlation. You specifically talk about and take a look at some of the church manuals and the way that they structure lessons. And maybe you can dissect that a little bit here.
I talk about the Gospel Principles Manual, which is used in several classes now. And I specifically discuss the lesson on prayer, or I'm sorry, not on prayer, on the Sabbath day, right? And this lesson, instead of really discussing, after a very brief discussion of the origins of the Sabbath day and several scriptures mentioning the Sabbath, most of the lesson is about how you can better practice the Sabbath in your own life and what sort of strategies you can use to live the Sabbath well, right? And this is clearly what the manual writers want the lesson to be about. We don't want to have a discussion about the theology of the Sabbath or how the Sabbath is theoretically different from Saturday or the shift from, you know, a seventh day to a Sunday Sabbath. We want to talk about how practicing the Sabbath can make us better people. And that is what the manuals are designed to do. And that is, I think, the rooted in correlation culture.
So you're a person who's sort of an academic bent, and so when you sit in a Sunday school class, I assume that you'd be more interested in talking about, you know, cultural issues or about theological issues.
Right. I mean, well, actually, I think when I kind of had this realization, that actually made Sunday school much more interesting to me than, you know, initially when I was all, you know, like kind of a frustrated young grad student and I wanted to kind of parse the Hebrew and everything and stuff like that. You know, I was much more frustrated. Now I'm like, oh, well, you know what we're doing here actually has a purpose. We're not just watering this down for the sake of watering it down. There's a reason behind it. And now I can kind of sit in there and think of Sunday school as a call and response litany,
Word catechism, actually.
I did use the word catechism and sort of this fascinating ritual worship, right, rather than an actual real school.
And that's a very fascinating part of the book that I think a lot of members of the church would be interested to read is your description of a 21st century Mormon family and how they experience their religion. It's going to be really helpful for people who aren't Mormons because it's going to explain what a Mormon sort of life is like. But that hasn't always been what the Mormon life is like. So take us back to the 19th century, late 19th century. So we're in the Great Basin. And what sort of life would a Mormon lead at that time? Because it's not the 3-hour block on Sunday church.
No. Yeah. Well, you know, you would have had Sunday meeting, likely. And if you're doing it, say, by the 1870s and 1880s, you probably would have been going to your ward, to a ward house. And there would be speakers who would go on for a very long time and usually not very well. And you would celebrate the Lord's Supper there. That would be
And what was that like? Because now, you know, we have it's very quiet during that time. And you talk about in the book this actual administration of the sacrament is a little bit different.
Yeah. Sometimes there would be preaching during the service. Brigham Young was known to sometimes break off in the middle of a sermon, bless the sacrament, then resume his sermon while it was being passed. And it would have been administered, of course, before the priesthood reforms by older men. And by the 1870s, 1880s, that would have been steadily moving to be the responsibility of the young men. But that would be what you would do on Sundays. Then during the week, you would go to any number of weeknight meetings, to quorum meetings, perhaps, or to a religious society meeting or a prayer group. Sometimes Sunday schools for children, the Sunday schools being instituted by the 1870s, 1880s as well. A lot of these meetings would have been on weeknights. It's not, you know, of course, until 1980s, when the 3-hour block is established and all of these meetings are moved to Sunday.
Do you see that as a direct product of correlation?
Yeah, I do, actually. I think it is also related to the desire to increase focus on sacrament meeting in particular and to make the sacrament meeting sort of the center piece of the worship service.
As far as young men and young women's, how different of an experience would Mormons today expect from what they might have expected in the late 19th century?
Oh, you know, from many of the auxiliaries, I think there is a sense in which this these sort of auxiliaries are becoming a class on Sundays, right? Away from being the sort of all-encompassing, very, very integrated into the aspects of daily life sort of groups that they were in the 19th century. And the Relief Society, of course, I think has this process has affected the most, but also to some extent young men and young women as well, although they still, you know, they're still mutual nights. So that is a thing.
And we've also taken on Boy Scouts in some of the, in the American church, at least.
The Boy Scouts. Which, you know, if there's ever a progressive organization, it was the Boy Scouts, I think.
Yeah, it sort of embodied that ethic of, you know.
Yeah, kind of improve yourself through hard work and through participation in this arcane and somewhat confusing organization.
Right. And you see that carrying through to even away from Boy Scouts, you see that sort of an ethic as being a part of at least American Mormonism today. Is that right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Very much. I think, you know, this is,
So when you're speaking of progressivism, that's the sort of thing we're talking about, right? Because unfortunately these labels shift in meaning over time. And so they become politically
absolutely
loaded.
What we're talking about here is kind of this classic American progressive ethos, which, is characterized in two ways. It's characterized first by a tremendous confidence in the capacity of human beings to improve themselves, both individually and as a society, but also a real confidence that organization and bureaucracy an institution can be mobilized to change people in useful ways. So if we just get enough information and train our social workers correctly, we can end poverty in America. And the progressives honestly, deeply, sincerely believe that. I think Mormons sort of, many of these ideas resonated with stuff that the Mormons already thought about, you know, optimism about human potential and so on, and the need for kind of this institution of the church. And I think this sort of progressive ethos fused with Mormonism in the 20th century and really generated this way of thinking about the church itself as being an organization where we go to work for each other and we go to cultivate our own souls and improve ourselves by serving other people.
Great. We're here with Matt Bowman. He's author of The Mormon People, a new one-volume history of the church from Random House. I'm going to read just a little excerpt from the book that I think really does a good job of encapsulating your overall theme, Matt, and then I'd like to hear you respond to that section of the book. Joseph Smith's ability to transform the mundane into the sacred, to find in a small group of farm families the seedbed of God's kingdom, or to see in Missouri Valley the Garden of Eden and the triumphant regathering of the family of God, can seem simultaneously absurd and breathtaking. So he gathered friends around him, men and women leaned upon, friends who were awed by the power of the revelations, but not so awed that they did not desire their own visions of the divine. Some of the prophetic utterances they would accept, some reject, and many more they would seize and seek to shape into their own worlds. The years in Kirtland and Missouri saw the halting construction of Zion, the struggle to bridge the gap between vision and creation, between Joseph Smith's desire to foster a people who gained a collective vision of God and his conviction that he had been particularly chosen to guide them to it. And together, they built the religion called Mormonism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the title of the book is The Mormon People, and you've put Joseph Smith as the prophet of the church originally, but that he work together with people to build what eventually became Mormonism. So can you talk a little bit about that as being an overarching theme of the book?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it really is the case, you know, and I opened the book with that comparison between this other guy, Robert Matthews, who also claimed to be a prophet and to be receiving revelations and wanted to build a kingdom, and Joseph Smith. And the difference between the two was that Joseph Smith was able to attract very capable people to him. And he was able to devolve enough of his own authority and devolve enough of his gifts and enough of his vision to others that when he died, the church would survive. And this was not true for Robert Matthews. He couldn't do that. And more, you know, the church is not simply the product of Joseph Smith himself. And he never thought it would be. You know, he wanted other people to step up and to seize initiative and to institute their own ideas and their own programs. And it was, I think, his capacity to give this vision of his to a group that really made Mormonism possible and has since, I think, that characterizes how the church has developed since. It's a product of many people, not simply one.
And you continue that on, I mean, to the end of the book and the conclusion, it seems you're still situating Mormonism within America as a reflection of some American principles, and also a reaction against some of the strains in American culture. Was that a perspective that you brought to the project, or one that you saw emerging as you continued to work on it?
No, I think that was, you know, it had been that conclusion where I talk about the Book of Mormon musical. That it's sort of a reflection of stuff I've been thinking about since I first heard about the musical and listened to the soundtrack and encountered the musical. You know, because I think the musical so much kind of embodies a lot of these tensions that the Mormons in the musical are very nice people. They're very friendly. They're very engaging and very wonderful. And they're also really, really dumb and naive and silly, right? And I looked at that and thought, huh, you know, these are not the really threatening Mormons of you know, A Study in Scarlet.
Right. What were those Mormons? Just for people who haven't read it, I'd like you to compare it to the ones in Study in Scarlet, or maybe some of the silent films about the Mormon missionaries.
Right, Trapped by the Mormons and all of that, right? This kind of sort of 19th century vision of Mormons as being this theocracy in the desert, and theocracy in the sense that it is governed dictatorially by Brigham Young. It's full of these evil elders who seduce and steal away women from passing pioneer trains. It's a police state run by the Avenging Angels, who go out and assassinate anybody who dares to disagree with Brigham Young.
It's all the, you know, all the things we miss about the church.
Yeah. You know, it is this really terrifying sort of institution. And then suddenly, 100 years later, you have the Book of Mormon musical. And they're like these just bumbling nice guys, right, who believe in silly things. So that sort of – but both of these groups are really, really not people that Americans want to associate with or elect president. You know, Brigham Young is terrifying and mean, and the guys in the Book of Mormon musical like aren't capable of holding their own church together. You know, so in neither case are these Mormons someone who really deserves full participation in American life. And that's sort of the fact that so much could change.
Yeah, whether you agree with those stereotypes, the fact that those stereotypes are so divergent within only 100 years of time is pretty striking.
Yeah, but they both kind of end in the same place, which is that Mormons aren't like us.
Right.
You know, so that kind of tension is something I follow through all the way, I think.
So what do you make of the musical as far as, like you said, they're not the word that all the reviews always use is sweetness.
Yeah.
There's a sweetness.
Right, exactly. And it is true, you know, like clearly these guys think that Mormons are nice people. And you know, you just can't trust them with anything important. You know, they're friendly and funny and all of that, but in no sense someone that you would want to be like operating on you or being your president.
Either or.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe both, I don't know.
Yeah.
If Mitt Romney had gone to medical school.
Right.
So you've had a chance now that after you've published the book, you've had a chance to sort of get in the spotlight a little bit. You've published columns on internet sites like the Huffington Post and Slate.com. How did those articles come about?
A couple ways. Random House gave me a publicist, which never ceases to baffle me. and some things she has booked. The Huffington Post approached me. Paul Rauschenbusch, who edits a religion for them, sent me an email and said, hey, we'd be interested in having you write something for us. And Slate also contacted me as well and asked for something. So,
what sort of things? Yeah. Do they give you an idea of what they want from you? Or?
Not really. Some of them just said, you know, write about Mormonism for us. You know, just whatever you think is important or useful. Slate asked to excerpt a portion of the book and asked me which part I thought would work well. And I said, probably the conclusion, which is what they did.
Yeah. Have you had a chance to look at any of the comment sections on any of those?
You never look at the comment section. That's like the number one rule of writing anything on the internet. Don't pay attention to the comments. So I have not.
So in other things that you've done, I saw you on MSNBC's morning show, Morning Joe. How did that come about?
That was through the publicist.
What's that like? What's it like going on to a morning show like that?
Oh no, it was sort of terrifying and sort of fascinating. I did not have a very good idea, I think, of what they were going to ask me about to begin with, and they asked me then about polygamy right out the gate, and I was not anticipating that. So
that's the first thing you should, right, anticipate.
Yeah, right. Well, I had dinner with Joanna Brooks that night, and Joanna told me, you have to have a polygamy paragraph. You know, you need a polygamy answer for whenever you're asked, because you will be asked.
Do you have yours now?
I have it now. I think. I don't know.
What else did they talk to you about? Do you remember on Morning Joe?
Oh, you know, I have not gone back and watched it.
I think it's the first time that anyone has ever said
Deckled.
The deckled first time edge. Anyone has said deckled edge on a news broadcast in the history of the United States.
That's rather esoteric. We talked a great deal, I think, about why Mormons are considered weird in America today. And then they asked me my opinion on that. I was really hoping we'd talk about Mitt Romney a little bit, but no.
I was surprised that didn't come up, but they did ask you about that. You know, Mormons are sort of seen as weird. And what would what was your answer to that? I mean, how do you answer
that? I think there are two reasons. One is there are not many Mormons in America, and the other is that Mormonism is young. And I think, you know, it was overcoming both of those things that allowed Catholics to normalize in the United States, and you know, Mormons aren't quite there yet.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the evangelical vote swing toward a Catholic in Rick Santorum. You know,
yeah.
That, I mean, that's a huge change right there.
Yeah. From 50, 60 years ago when evangelicals were mobilizing against John F. Kennedy. Norman Vincent Peale, of all people, the guy who wrote The Power of Positive Thinking, hated John F. Kennedy because he was a Catholic. But, you know, now evangelicals don't have a problem with that anymore.
Well, his positive thinking didn't keep JFK out of the office.
That is true. JFK gave a speech, I think, which said essentially, I will govern like a Protestant if I'm elected.
That's right. What sort of differences do you see between the speech that JFK gave and that Mitt Romney gave? They both gave sort of a speech on their faith in America and politics.
I think JFK was aware of what he was doing, and I don't think Romney was.
As far as knowing what his audience needed to hear, or
I think actually, you know, Romney was dinged a lot for not talking about Mormonism enough in that speech. I think he did. I think he said exactly what he thought Mormonism meant, which is, we work hard, we believe in American values, we live good lives, we're moral, ethical people.
We have a family.
Yeah, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And he did not, though, really engage, I think, with the stuff that people were worried about, primarily because I don't think Mitt Romney actually thinks there's anything standing in between him and being a good president. His Mormonism is not an obstacle. To him, in his own mind, he cannot, I think, conceive of why it would be an obstacle. So he may just have a problem of imagination here.
Wouldn't that be something you'd think some advisors would be able to talk to him about or something?
You would think, right? But Kennedy knew exactly what he was doing, and he knew exactly the sort of speech he needed to give, and he did it.
Do you think Romney will have to deliver another speech like that, or do you think that's in the past?
Yeah, I think it's. I think if the economy gets worse, Romney will win, and if it stays the same or gets better, Obama will win.
So he wouldn't need to address the religion question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there will always be people, you know, antsy about it and upset about it, but I don't think there is much he can do at this point to make it a non-issue. I think he is probably best served not talking about it.
Having a prominent Mormon like Romney in the spotlight, so far it's brought a little bit of attention from more conservative people, and usually the evangelical-minded folks. But if Romney was to take on President Obama in a general election, do you think there would be a reaction from the left on mm-hmm. Mormonism?
Yeah, and there already is. You know, but it's really the same people. It is the same people who think evangelicals are stupid. And, you know, the same people, you know, the Bill Maher fans, right. The people who think religion in general is dumb.
And like Lawrence O'Donnell is another one.
Yeah. You know, and these people, you know, these people find Mormonism maybe a bit more fruitful because Mormonism has all this sort of exotic and esoteric stuff associated with it. But it would be, you know, if say, heaven forbid, Michelle Bachmann had gotten the Republican nomination, you know, she would be facing exactly the same sort of stuff that Romney is.
Right.
Just be about evangelicalism
rather than Mormonism. That's a good point. I'm curious. It seems to me that the media attention that's been focused on Romney this time around, as opposed to in the 2008 election, has been a little bit more positive, actually. And that's the general impression I've gotten. There have been a few things that I've seen that weren't that positive. There were a few things in the New York Times that were surprising, but for the most part, it's felt to me like it's been sort of positive. Is that the impression that you've gotten as well?
Yeah, you know, I think many of the more serious media outlets have really kind of gotten over the first like, oh, weird, he's a Mormon, you know, they're now kind of seriously trying to think about what that might mean, and they're really taking Mormonism seriously. I mean, I've spoken to people from the Washington Post and people from CNN, the Christian Science Monitor, some fairly serious media outlets who asked me some really kind of interesting and penetrating questions about like Mormon leadership culture and things like that.
What sort of things? Are they wondering if he would be in league with the church presidency or something?
No. But just sort of like, you know, he was a lay leader of his church for so long. You know, like, what kind of leadership lessons would he have drawn from that?
Mm-hmm.
Do bishops sort of just decide whatever is going to happen in a ward and then kind of lay it down by fiat? And you know, so I talk when I do these interviews, I talk about kind of the leadership by committee sort of style of, you know, of a presidency and ward councils and quorums and this sort of quest for consensus that you see a lot. So they are, I think, getting into really nitty gritty and not really lurid and sort of sensational ideas about what Mormonism is like. You know, they're getting beyond that.
Yeah, it seems some of the articles I've seen, there was one just this past Sunday, I think, in the Washington Post on Romney as some of his mission experiences and college experiences that I thought was very, very well done. And I think the author of that wasn't a member of the church, but...
No. Was it Anne Gearhart?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, she's the one I talked to.
Or it might have been a gentleman that wrote this one, but whoever it was, I thought it was really well done. I don't think people realize sometimes how difficult it can be for a journalist who doesn't typically cover religious issues to take on something like this.
Yeah, and I think for the most part, even the New York Times, you know, like Larry something, the woman on the Romney beat on the New York Times, has actually done a really good job. And I think many of the mainstream media outlets have.
It seems to me that Romney's sort of in a difficult position when people ask him about his faith, because there's when it's used in an attack, there's always the tendency to answer with, you know, there's no religious test for the oath of office. That's sort of an easy way. Then on the flip side, though, politicians want to talk about how their faith does inform the policies that they that they make. President Obama's done that. Rick Santorum has done that. George W. Bush has done that. So there seems to be a tension there in American political life then about not having a test for the oath of office, but also the way that faith does inform politics.
Yeah. You know, and I think Romney does talk about his faith. Whenever he talks about his family, whenever he talks about the way he's lived his life, he's talking about his faith. And he would really like to be part of this Judeo-Christian tradition, you know, the sort of ethical, moral Christianity, this consensus that's been really settled in American politics for the past 70 years or so. Mormons are sort of in there. You know, we had Ezra Taft Benson in the cabinet and stuff like that, but not all the way. And he's facing problems because other people want to talk about theology and he does not.
All right. We're here with Matt Bowman. He's the author of The Mormon People. It's a new book from Random House, a one volume history of the church. And I had the privilege of reading through it and found it to be really well done, Matt.
Thank you.
One question I have is there anything in the book that you think the average Mormon might find surprising as they read it?
Oh, well, who's the average Mormon?
Yeah, the mythical average Mormon, right?
Just the average listener to this podcast, maybe not so much.
Yeah. No, this podcast has a wide, wide footprint, Matt.
I'm sure.
All 8 of our listeners out there.
Oh, you know, I don't know. I think you know, maybe the 20th century stuff and what I've heard from like friends and other people who have read it, most people find the chapter that covers the period between the end of polygamy and David O. McKay interesting, because they just didn't know much about that period, which I think is true about most Americans in that period of American history more generally. You know, so
that time period where you had basically the turn of the century and then you had this progressive optimistic thing, and then you had the world wars that sort of put a big damper on that, and then
Great Depression and all of that sort of stuff.
So I ask you about the reactions you've gotten from non-members of the church, and you said that some of them have been pretty positive and other ones have been thought that you were soft chewing a little too much.
Yeah,
do you think? What sort of things were they not happy with?
Well, you know, a fairly standard reference in most of the critical reviews has been, I did not engage with Big Love and I did not engage with John Krakauer's Under the Banner of Heaven.
Yeah. See, that was going to be part 2 of our podcast, which was a full 3-hour analysis of John Krakauer's Under the Banner.
Oh, man, yeah.
What do you make of that?
And frankly, I mean, my response was when I read that review and this person dinged me for not dealing with John Krakauer's theories about Mormonism, I just said, well, it never occurred to me that I would have to, you know, because right. The book is, but you know, I mean, this has made me kind of take that book more seriously
exactly.
because it has been out for 10 years now. It is still usually number two or number three on Amazon's rank of best-selling books about Mormonism 10 years after it came out, and it's in every airport in the country. And I think it is, actually, it is a book that most non-Mormons think of as being a Mormon history book. So in retrospect, I actually sort of wish I had a paragraph on it in the book.
Right, and you could have situated it within. I think with people can get a bird's eye view of where that book fits in overall Mormon historiography.
I could have done it. You know, I easily could have done it.
How would you have done that? How would you have placed it in that?
It did not occur to me to do it. Oh, you know, I would have put it near the end of the book where I sort of deal very briefly with kind of pop culture and Mormonism in the 20th century. And I would have had a paragraph about the book and said, look, what this book really is the descendant of A Study in Scarlet. It's the descendant of Zane Grey's writer of Those of the Purple Sage. It's the descendant of all of these 19th century potboilers that presented Mormons as kind of this ominous, violent tyranny in the West. And as such, it works better as a literary narrative than as a work of history. It's trashy history, in large measure, but it's a really well written and tightly woven and really compelling story. Unfortunately, you know, it is trashy history.
Yeah. Krakauer, he brings the tools of a journalist, which is the ability to really tell a compelling story.
But his research is slanted and flawed, enormously so.
I think this is the same reviewer who got after you for not mentioning the Osmonds too, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, actually, there were two reviewers who got after me for not mentioning Banner of Heaven, and one of them also wanted more Osmonds, and the other one wanted Big Love.
See, and I'd forgot. I have to admit, it's terrible of me to, you know, I read the book early on and. That didn't cross my mind, and part of that is because I guess that's just background noise to me. Whereas there are people that grew up in the United States, away from Utah, and away from Mormonism, who that might have been their first experience with what a Mormon was, right?
Absolutely, you know, and frankly, honestly, you know, there would have been good reasons for putting in the Osmonds. That's that's a kind of a fair argument to make. You know, maybe the Osmonds did deserve to be in here. Maybe I should have cut Stephen Covey or Orson Scott Card and put in the Osmonds instead.
Yeah, well, you did get Orson Scott Card though, so that's good. Did you?
Yes,
I don't remember. Did you mention that they are making the movie now, or
the Ender's Game movie? No, this is before I heard about it when I wrote that. So that got gearing up about the same time. Well, I mean, it's been in production for 10 years or whatever.
Right.
You know, but yeah, it's underway, and seriously so, apparently.
That's right. So what kind of things do you have on the let's see how I want to phrase this.
On the docket coming up.
Good. Let me phrase it that way. So what kind of things do you have on the docket coming up now that you've finished the book and you're teaching, and what else have you got going on?
Well, I wrote this book while taking a break on my dissertation. So I paused revising my dissertation and wrote a book and then returned to revising my dissertation for publication. So I've just wrapped that up and sent it off to the press for consideration. It's under review. And now I'm sort of just dealing with all the aftermath, the fallout of the book. And doing things like this podcast and writing columns for the Huffington Post and that sort of thing, but you know, I am intrigued increasingly with Mormonism in the Progressive Era, and I think I may try to do a book or some project about, you know, kind of progressivism and its influence in Mormonism, but that's sort of hovering out there. And I've been thinking about writing a history of Mormon worship for a while too. So that's a possibility as well. There's an article that's right now being reviewed in a journal on Mormon worship. And I've been kicking around also doing a biography of L. Ron Hubbard for a while.
So people always wonder how you get all this stuff done. Like, how do you have all the time to do all this stuff?
I don't know. I don't feel like I'm that remarkably productive, actually. which may be why I get a lot of it done, because I don't feel like I'm doing a lot. So.
All right, so to close up here, I thought it'd be kind of fun to play a little counterfactual history game with you. So just to get your ideas on maybe how the church would be different today if a couple of things had shaken out a little bit differently. So first, let's go back to, say, about 1930. This will be our first one. So you got B.H. Roberts and Joseph Fielding Smith. B.H. Roberts is putting together his book, The Truth, the Way, and the Life. And it includes discussion of pre-Adamites and some speculative ideas about evolution and Adam and Eve being brought here from another planet and that sort of thing. So, and Joseph Fielding Smith, on the other hand, was the one who was sort of opposed to the idea of teaching evolution in the church. He eventually published Man, His Origin and Destiny, which talks about evolution as being an evil principle. Okay, so let's suppose that Joseph Fielding Smith's book never got published, and that B.H. Roberts' book did, and held that place. So what kind of differences would you speculate might we see today?
Oh man, you know that's hard to say, and the first question is Man, His Origin, His Destiny the only thing that Joseph Fielding Smith does not publish? I mean, is he doing Answers to Gospel Questions?
No, yeah, so all of that. So it wouldn't
is he Answers doing to all
Gospel
of his essays?
Let's suppose their ages were switched and that Joseph Fielding Smith passed away at that point. He had B.H. Roberts go on to publish his works, and
so
perhaps
B.H. Roberts is like president
becoming
of the
president,
of 60
yes.
years and all of that.
Yeah.
Oh, heavens, you know? I don't know. I mean, well, the thing to remember, and I think this point of the book too, actually, is that this isn't actually that dramatic a conflict compared to what's going on in Protestantism at this point. Like, all of the Mormons, everyone involved in this controversy, Talmadge, Roberts, Joseph Fielding Smith, they all believe that Adam and Eve are real people.
Right.
And none of them believe that Adam and Eve are the product of evolution necessarily.
That's right.
You know, this dispute within Mormonism is existing on a fairly narrow spectrum. So I don't know that if B.H. Roberts had lived, that the church would have kind of developed this sort of healthy, this robust, quite liberal theological tradition. I don't think that would have happened. I think the church would have remained fairly conservative on these issues.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, because you look at B.H. Roberts, and even at the time, I mean, he was a brilliant guy, but he was working with some outdated science himself, and I just wonder how flexible he would have been, you know, a little bit later on, right?
I forget the exact wording of the quote, B.H. Roberts is reading Henry Ward Beecher, who is he's a popularizer. He's not really an original thinker, but he is one of the leading Protestant ministers of the 19th century. He is a hugely popular person. His sermon collections are selling page upon, thousands and thousands of copies, and everyone knows who he is. He's this massive celebrity, and he is a very fairly liberal Protestant theologian, a liberal Protestant thinker. And he has all this stuff about how we don't need to take the Old Testament seriously. The Garden of Eden is a metaphor, so on and so forth. And Roberts writes this kind of scathing dismissal of Henry Ward Beecher. I have a copy of the book right here.
Yeah, I'm trying to find it.
I think I remember where it is. So
it's on page 181.
Yes, exactly. Roberts dismisses Beecher and says, "Such were the views of the late Henry Ward Beecher, and in fact all of his school, which I am sorry to say is rapidly increasing in number." Right? So Roberts has nothing but contempt for liberal Protestant thinkers, even though he is absorbing many of their kind of ideas about progress and development and all of that. Their theology, their biblical theology, he cannot stand.
That's what's interesting about Roberts' use of non-Mormon scholars versus Joseph Fielding Smith, is you see Roberts incorporating ideas from people like Beecher, but also dissenting from them on certain things.
Yes.
Whereas with Joseph Fielding Smith, you see him literally borrowing things from George McCready Price, a Seventh-day Adventist fellow, on the age of the earth and things like this, and not really attributing it to him, and not really taking any you know, any shots at him. Roberts is going to work with his non-Mormon sources and fight with them a little bit. Joseph Fielding Smith's going to incorporate stuff and not really talk about it.
Yeah. And that's, I think, one of the characteristics of this kind of Mormon progressive moment is this willingness to read Herbert Spencer, for instance, who is very influential, or John Fiske, or Beecher, or any of these other guys, and say, well, yeah, what can these guys teach me about how I practice my Mormonism? You know, what can these guys help? How can these guys help me understand Mormonism better? Which I think, you know, you see that a little bit in Joseph Fielding Smith. He's reading Price, but he's not really like out there embracing the philosophies of men, you know, the ways that these other guys are and finding very useful. And of course, by the time you reach Bruce R. McConkie, he is adamant about not doing that. He is not at all interested in engaging with scholarship of other traditions at all.
So that being said about Roberts, another thing that's interesting about that is B.H. Roberts has sort of become almost a cultural hero for some people who think that he became a closet doubter toward the end of his life. And do you think that's a convincing narrative about him, or do you see something else happening with B.H. Roberts?
Oh yeah, no, not so much. I think what we're seeing there really is a sort of intellectual style that Roberts and these other progressive guys had. That's just sort of unfamiliar to us now, you know, this sort of expansiveness of mind, expansiveness of capacities, and this willingness to kind of think through Mormon theology in really interesting ways. Yeah, so I think you know, he's not doing much intellectually that, say, like Talmage, I think Talmage is a little bit more conservative, but certainly Roberts is nowhere near as liberal theologically as John Widtsoe is. And no one's thinking of Widtsoe's closet doubter.
Okay, so here's the other hypothetical. Let's suppose correlation didn't subsume all of the auxiliaries. So you had the primary, Sunday school, young men, young women's, and the Relief Society all stayed independent budget wise and curriculum wise. So how do you think that would have impacted the modern church today if that centralization hadn't occurred?
Oh, the main thing they were afraid of is schism. And kind of the rise of like a Mexican Mormonism or an African Mormonism, and these kind of groups sort of spinning off and developing far more independent culturally, far more independently theologically. And yeah, I mean, I think that sort of thing, there would have been a lot more diversity within the church, which might have been a good thing, but might also have meant that there would have been fragmentation, which was something they were quite afraid of.
Do you think that was a plausible fear, or do you?
Perhaps. There were those guys, you know, all those guys who discovered the Book of Mormon in Africa.
In Nigeria, right?
Yeah, the Nigerians, who sort of were doing their own thing for a while, which is very fascinating, actually.
Yeah.
And then there was the third convention people in Mexico. Who were doing something quite similar. Hmm. And I forget when exactly that was.
Yeah, that one's not familiar to me.
Yeah, yeah. Jared Thomas has talked about this. But a bunch of guys who basically did set up kind of an indigenous Mexican version of the church. So I think, you know, there were kind of gestures toward this there. And I think, you know, I mean, the Nigerian thing was going on while David O. McKay and Harold B. Lee were talking about doing something like correlation to begin with, you know, so I think it's certainly that kind of specter was looming over their minds as they thought.
And here's your third counterfactual. Take you back to 1893, Chicago World's Fair. The Mormon Tabernacle Choir goes to the great choir competition and walks away with the silver medal. Now, let's suppose they walk away with a gold medal. Do you think that would have had any impact on American and Mormon culture from that time, had they taken home the golden goose?
Oh, you know, music and the spoken word might have begun even earlier. And I mean, that's been around for decades and decades and decades. So music and the spoken word was pretty popular by the 50s already. So done even better, perhaps.
It's too bad.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you joining me today, Matt. Again, the book that you wrote is The Mormon People, The Making of an American Faith. It was published by Random House. And certainly recommend everybody to grab a copy and maybe pick up a few extras to pass around the ward too.
Yeah, and I'm coming to Utah in March.
In March?
Yes, so I will be speaking at the University of Utah on March 17th, at the Church History Library on March 15th, and at the Bountiful Barnes and Noble on the 9th of March 15th.
I used to live right down the street from there in Centerville.
So did I.
Did you? You lived near
Bountiful? I grew up in Woods Cross.
Oh, right on. Cool. Thanks for joining us, Matt.
Yeah, absolutely.